Welcome to Between Realities. This is a podcast about virtual reality with a nice heavy dose of philosophy. My name is Alex VR, and I am joined here with my co-host Skiva. How are you, my good friend?
What's up, buddy? I'm great, man. How are you?
Things could be a lot worse, man.
Yeah,
I hear you. Worse.
I hear you.
I'm really excited.
Yeah, me too, man. We got an excellent show today. We're going to skip a lot of the news that we normally do, and we're just going to dive into the meat and the potatoes of these conversations we're going to have because we're just too excited for anything else. So
yeah, absolutely. Before we get started, we'll take the opportunity to tell you, please, if you're into this kind of stuff, subscribe to the channel, like the video. We are definitely ready for a larger audience, so do not be shy. Join us, join the conversation when we're live, and if you can't catch it because you're in Europe right now, because I know it gets late over there, don't hesitate to comment, and we'll jump in there, and we can keep the conversation going there as well. So our guest today, it's obvious we've been blasting it on Twitter and it's in the title and all of that stuff. And I know that's always kind of weird to reveal the curtain on this kind of stuff when everybody knows exactly what to expect. But this guy, he was actually the first person to comment on a Between Realities podcast episode as soon as we premiered the episode. It was super, super awesome. He is the host of the Voices of VR podcast. He has interviewed over 900 VR industry professionals, leaders, and creators. Please welcome to Between Realities, Mr. Kent Bai.
Hey!
Yo!
What's up, Kent?
Hey. Thanks for having me, Alex and Skiva. This is great to be here. I'm excited to dive in.
Yes, man. Awesome. We are super, super excited. It's great to see you again. I didn't really know who you were when I was in your vicinity at Oculus Connect 6, which is why I wore this shirt today to kind of represent that time, because that is when I had my introduction to Kent Bai. I was there as a budding VR content creator with a microphone and a selfie stick, and I was putting my microphone in as many faces as possible, but there was one dude there that was beating me to it, and that was Kent Bai. Man, this guy was in you were in every single room, every building, every person who I fucking saw at this conference. You were there sitting in a corner somewhere with your hand on your knee, just like letting them go, man. Like, I immediately was like taken back by the work ethic and the dedication to the craft. So you have definitely earned my respect by just witnessing you there.
Yeah, well, I feel like I get into flow states when I go to these conferences, and I actually started back in 2014 at the Silicon Valley Virtual Reality Conference, where I did 46 interviews in a day and a half, it was over the 2 days of the conference, and so I felt like that there was this history that was unfolding, and I felt like this moral responsibility to capture it and to chase my own curiosities about what it is and where it's going. And so when I do go to these conferences, I end up, pretty nonstop for 14 to 16 hours a day doing lots of interviews. Total number of interviews I've recorded is probably around 1,500, but I've published about 900 of them. So I've got another 400 to 500 or so that I haven't published yet. So
that's a staggering number, dude.
Wow.
That's a staggering number. Like, are you like a teacher who like remembers the name of like every student that they've had for like 30 years? Like, do you have a connection with all of it, or like, does it start to get lost in the shuffle?
Well, I remember names and contexts and topics, not always at this point, not always the names, because it is over like 1500 names.
That's a lot.
Probably 3,000 to 4,000 people within the VR industry, and maybe attended somewhere between 70 to 100 events. I need to kind of do a full accounting just to see, but I've been trying to attend as many of the different conferences as I can just to help document the unfolding of this whole medium. And I feel like I've in some ways captured the golden era of virtual reality conferences, because now with coronavirus and COVID-19, I feel like whatever happens here going forward, it's going to be different. And so unique moment in the history and the evolution of VR, that I have a hard time seeing how we're going to be able to go back completely to that. It may be a number of years and we may, but I feel like whatever happens right now, we're going to be taking what is available and we're going to be moving forward into really pushing the limits of what we already have.
And before we get into what's going to happen, I do want to kind of just figure out like what happened with Mr. Kent Bai. Like, we talk about like VR and we talk about philosophy. Were you a gamer before you had an interest in either of those things? Are you a gamer at all?
Well, so I played a lot of games growing up. I'm 43 right now. And so I stopped playing video games in like 1995. almost 19 years break in 2014 and started playing again. And so it wasn't until VR came along that I started playing, but I'd say like my primary driver has been more of the intellectual philosophical aspects of the whole thing. You know, in fact, at the very first Silicon Valley Virtual Reality Conference, I think I maybe did one or two demos, and it took me a while to kind of switch that whole paradigm where I wanted to focus first on experiencing everything rather than talking to people. But because I was interviewing people, I focused primarily on just having those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say there's some deep like questions about the nature of reality, nature of consciousness that, you know, drive me. And then eventually there was a part where storytelling and immersive storytelling seemed to be a thing that no one had really fully figured out. And it was a real strength in the medium. And, you know, what are the ways in which that you can make sense of what are the new story elements and how do you make sense of a story? And so I think that that's been a primary driver as well. Also just, I see that VR represents this new paradigm. It's like this new, it's opening up new aspects of how we understand reality. And so it gives mm-hmm. us language, a new spatial language, but that we're in some ways able to provide people a consistent experience and that we're able to, in some ways, calibrate our phenomenological qualitative experiences that we mm-hmm. didn't do that before. We've never mm-hmm. been able to go play this level in Beat Saber or go play this game, Half-Life Alyx, and be able to say, okay, well, we've had video games, but you know, to have a full immersive sensory experience where you can start to see something and see how you feel and be able to start to develop it and cultivate the language of talking about your embodied experiences with other people. And I think that's a big part of what's happening right now in VR is that it's forcing us to be able to find new language to be able to talk about things.
Mm-hmm. And I do think it's an important distinction for anybody who might be new to this kind of conversation, because it's not every day that, you know, people are like sitting down, breaking this kind of stuff down. But, you know, this is what we're really talking about here is the true essence and nature of reality. Like what is real, what's not real, and how does virtual reality, VR, tie into that conversation? You know, I'm curious as to like when, like how your philosophical journey started. Like what is it that like flipped the light on or like got you starting to like question your reality? Do you remember it?
Well, I would say that, you know, going back to 2002, 2003, it was a buildup to the war in Iraq, and I started watching a lot of the media. And I was told on, I think it was April 22nd or August 22nd, 2002, by Scott Ritter, I went to a lecture and he said, there's no weapons of mass destruction and it's all going to be a lie and we're going to go to war in Iraq. And then 4 days later, they kind of launched the PR campaign to sell the war. So then I started recording the media and then tracking the propaganda campaign to sell the war. And then eventually I did a bunch of interviews with journalists and think tank scholars, media critics, and conservatives and people who were for the war, against the war, you know, Grover Norquist, Helen Thomas, Bill Plant, all these people from the media. And that was in some ways my introduction into journalism and critiquing journalism by interviewing the journalists about journalism itself. And mm-hmm. I learned a lot about what it means to be a journalist there. But afterwards, what happened was that I needed some framework to make sense of, you know, like I would hear, I had this experience of not agreeing completely 100% with everybody or disagreeing completely 100% with everybody. There was always something that was different. And there was a lot of different approaches for how to even make sense of the media. And that's when I came across the work of Ken Wilber and Integral Theory that really helped me understand the different aspects of how to break down into his framework, at least. And then what happened was that I was watching a video about Marshall McLuhan, and there was a piece in there by Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Nice.
book. And he talked about this concept of the noosphere. And the noosphere, I was like, what is the noosphere? And so I looked up online the noosphere. And it was like he had kind of imagined that this, he kind of imagined what the internet and the metaverse would be back at, you know, the turn of the century, back at like 1890 or so. And so, but there was this Institute of Noetic Sciences, which studied consciousness. And I found the Institute of Noetic Sciences website, and I was living in Maine at the time. And I saw a week later, in the middle of nowhere, Maine, the president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences was going to be speaking about consciousness. So it was sort of like from Noosphere to Institute of Noetic Sciences to like the president is going to be in my backyard next week. And it was on the anniversary of 9/11. It was on September 11th, 2004.
Wow.
So it was, I went to that talk, and what happened was that I was looking a lot about physics, and, you know, I was like, okay, which approach do you take? Do you take like the superstring theory or quantum mechanics to think about? And the person I was talking to was basically like, look, neither one of those can account for consciousness. And I was like, what? And so it was that moment when I started to kind of go on this journey of like, what is consciousness and why can't we understand it yet? And the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I don't know if you know about it, they're actually started by Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon. And when he came back, he actually had this epiphanic spiritual
opening. Yeah. Just by seeing the planet in its entirety, it just like triggered something or just like created a new pathway that just like completely shifted his perspective on life and the world and everything, right?
Yeah, he came back and he had this breakthrough experience, and he looked through all the scientific literature. He couldn't find anything about it. He looked through all the religious literature, couldn't find anything about it. And it wasn't until he looked into like the mystical Hindu literature that he found the concept of the samadhi. And he's like, well, if this is a concept that other people have studied, then I should be able to experience this as well. And so he started the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and they do a lot of frontier research. So they were doing a lot of stuff with meditation. I mean, to this day, right now, like meditation is pretty mainstream, right? But meditation, even, you know, 20, 30 years ago was not like a mainstream thing. And it was quite controversial that it was a very dualistic type of approach or reductive materialistic approach where, you know, they wouldn't necessarily, the scientists wouldn't say that there would be any, their paradigm and framework would say that there'd be no legitimacy to meditation. And so for the longest time, the mainstream paradigm was rejecting any sort of science or that it would even be a legitimate field of inquiry. Mm-hmm. But Institute of Noetic Sciences was really doing this frontier research. And so it was actually from interviewing people like Dean Radin, who started to talk about things like Thomas Kuhn and the structures of scientific revolutions and paradigms. And because he was looking at like different aspects of psychic phenomena, it was things that were outside of the mainstream paradigm. And because it was things that weren't talked about and taboo, he had the most to say about the philosophy of science. So it was sort of like this catalyst of like looking at a direct embodied experience of like having psychic premonitions or something like that. And this is still, it's an area that is still not very well understood, but I had that sort of an intrinsic interest in those type of eccentric things. You know, I was a big fan of X-Files and, you know, always kind of into UFOs and kind of the eccentric, you know, wanting to see what the mainstream paradigm was and kind of go beyond that. Go ahead.
Well, and I feel like, you know, like the whole like mystical realm and like and all of that, like there's a lot of people who almost chalk that kind of stuff up as to this like anecdotal, because a lot of that, you know, for a lot of people, like, you know, for me, you know, I talked before the show about kind of my interest in philosophy and how it got started. But, you know, to be completely honest, like I feel like the catalyst for me was hallucinogenic experience. And when a lot of people have hallucinogenic experience, they often talk about these very, very profound like spiritual-like experiences that they have. And, you know, I feel like from my experience, like when I came back, I was just like, holy shit. And I just like, you know, boom, like hit it hard and like really started to question my reality and what's real and what's not real, what's important, what's worth putting energy into and what's not. But I feel like that is anecdotal and oftentimes perceived as that. Do you think that like there's a place at the table for this in this conversation right now?
Well, if we look at the thing that you're talking about, if you sort of unpack the philosophy of science, the science, and it has, well, first to take a step back and to, it's impossible to believe all truths and to dismiss all falsehoods at the same time. And so that's why you need what Agnes Callard says is the adversarial division of epistemic labor. So let's break that down, what that means. Adversarial division of epistemic labor. That means that you have people who believe and the people who are skeptical. And so science itself is trying to, you know, you may believe in a certain theory, you may test it, you may provide evidence, but the larger community is not going to accept it until it can be replicated. And that's a healthy part of establishing what is true and what is not true. Mm-hmm. And so we have ways of determining justice by having the prosecutor defend for the client, for the people that they're defending and representing, and then the prosecution and the defendant. You need both of the prosecution and the defense in order to get justice. And they need to collaborate in this process together. And so you need the process of people believing and disbelieving in order to collaborate towards to get to truth. Okay, so that's sort of the scientific process does that. Now, the challenge with any sort of direct phenomenological experience is that you can't replicate human experience and you can't falsify it. And so this introduces like a new aspect of like, how do you deal with that phenomenological experiences? Now, there's some direction which is called neurophenomenology, which is to take the neurological correlates of your direct experience and try to correlate that to that. And so then you're trying to account for both your first-person perspective as well as what's happening in your body. But the problem has been that a lot of times people's subjective experiences are kind of taking in all the sensory input and they're associating a story to it after the fact. Mm-hmm. And sort of science has found that to be notoriously unreliable. Mm-hmm. There's been this almost dismissing of our direct experiences because it's hard to have any sort of control around. So I feel like that's, in some ways, VR starts to open up this new capability to be able to now, you know, standardize all the different variables of a direct phenomenological experience. And then maybe you start to pull out some of those nuances, but how to balance subjectivity and objectivity is still a big open question, but I feel like VR provides this platform to potentially start to connect some of those dots.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you think about the way that, like, you know, our current perceived reality is built up. It's just like a culmination of the sensory perception input. And VR is like currently, you know, this like rudimentary version of it, right? Like we just like have to like flash these lights over our eyes and try to get as close as possible to the normal human refresh rate, which I forget. Do you know what that is, Skiva? The refresh rate of the human eye?
I don't think it's really known, is it? I mean,
I don't know. I guess maybe not. I don't know.
I think it's called Percept, and I think it might be like every 200 milliseconds or something, there's like a consolidation of sensory input. I think it might vary based upon what the input is, but mm-hmm, it does have like a quantized effect of like there is a bit of a sampling rate of your brain kind of like assembling all of the sensory input and making a model. The predictive coding model of neuroscience has this sort of like you have a mental model of what you expect, and then you have the direct sensory experience of what you're experiencing, but that's a feedback loop that's actually directly connected. So your paradigm and your beliefs and your prior experiences are shaping your reality that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. So you are making a prediction about what you see, and then you take that sensory input, and then there's like this error code that happens. And so you take that error code, and then that's like fed back in, and you sort of adapt. And so the thing that makes gaming and VR so interesting is that it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. So it sort of stimulates that dopamine response in our brains to be able to make those predictions, but to then correct them. And so there's that experience of novelty and joy, and, you know, but also it can start to train the neural pathways into our brain to be able to start to perceive things that we couldn't perceive before. A lot of what I think consciousness is about is the spectrum of contrast. So you have different polarity points, and by being able to recognize the subtle differences between two extremes, you're able to then come up with language around that. One of the favorite things that I've liked to talk about is this wine tasting and what happens when you, do you guys drink wine at all?
A little bit. I'm not a snob, but I drink it.
Well, I'm not either, so also critical for me. But assume that you were drinking a lot of wine. You would have to drink a lot of wine, and then when you drink that wine, you're able to notice the subtle differences of the flavors. Mm-hmm. And as you notice the subtle differences of the flavors, you start to associate language to that, so that when you drink the wine, you can start to have a deeper experience.
Oh, yes. Chalk and dried leather in my mom's basement. You know, like you're associating all of these like memories or like other things that ultimately, I guess, have nothing to do, but you're giving language to the nuances and subtleties that you're tasting in the wine.
Yeah. And as you come up with that language and ways of describing it, then it actually deepens your experience of the wine. Like people who drink a lot of wine arguably have a more rich experience when they drink it. And I think that's actually what's happening when we play VR, is that we're sort of putting ourselves into these situations, and we're able to notice the more subtle nuances of our direct experience. Like, how present do we feel when we're in this virtuality experience? And that when we start to talk to other people who've had that same experience, then we can start to calibrate those different levels of our phenomenological experiences, and we can start to have a shared culture that starts to get cultivated in that way.
Do you see the mainstream implementation of virtual reality technology as inevitable?
Well, so a while ago I was saying, you know, I thought that VR and AR was going to be mainstream by 2025, but
yeah.
Because there was something about like what happens through the course of 2020 that, whether it's ecological devastation or the coronavirus, you know, I feel like there's an opportunity right now for us to do like this global reset in terms of, you know, how we run our society, our culture. First and foremost, there's economy that has been based upon consumption of physical goods. And, you know, there's been some experiential part of, you know, the travel industry and service industry, but a lot of that's still dependent upon physically traveling and with gasoline and whatnot. And at this point, we don't know if the coronavirus and COVID-19 is going to be something that is on the order of a couple of years and we have a vaccine and then we move on, or, you know, what if this is a situation that just is like AIDS or other viruses that don't have a vaccine and just becomes endemic, and we have to learn to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, I kind of sit with that reality. It's not a reality that I want to sit too much with, but it's a reality that I think is a real possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about like the future of VR, this moment is the small window that people see is either going to be an ephemeral moment and we're going to move on. And then people may forget, but about VR in terms of what it's able to do, but this could also be an opportunity for people to really say, okay, let's assume that things are not going to go back to the way they were, and we need to find new ways of using immersive technologies to be able to do some of the things we used to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're at right now is that trying to find, you know, either whether it's through remote education, collaboration, but we have this real split in the world right now of the haves and the have-nots, you know, the people who are able to still continue to work, people who are not able to work. And so there's, in terms of design justice of creating a society where you have something that is like the veil of ignorance from, you know, the theory of justice from Rawls, where if you were to design a society and you had no choice as to whether or not to be born into a certain family or amount of wealth and privilege, then how would you design that society? And that doesn't seem to be how our societies are designed. It feels like it's the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And that because we've had a number of different geopolitical and economic decisions that have made that gap even more extreme, that's just not sustainable in the long run. So when I think about the future of immersive technologies, it has the real potential to be a democratizing influence, to be able to give access to education and experiences to people who wouldn't normally have it. But at this point, you still have to be pretty well off to even have access to a lot of the technology. And then if you do have the technology, you need Wi-Fi. So, you know,
right.
You need all these things that are not, and as we move forward with like, you know, a significant portion of the United States unemployed, I think there's going to be a bit of like, how do we imagine a future that is restructured that could move into an experiential economy? If we, if we need to sort of reevaluate, is it universal basic income? I feel like there's some deeper questions that I don't know where this is going to go, but, you know, thinking about it philosophically, as I think about all these potentials, But I do think that VR and AR is inevitable.
Yes, that's good.
It's definitely interesting that that VR was. I feel like VR was about to get its magic moment, you know, with Half-Life Alyx, with Oculus Quest coming out and bringing the price point down of hardware that you don't need a full gaming PC to run. I feel like, you know, we were taking a big step up, and then this whole unfortunate thing hit, and it ruined a lot of industries. I'm not saying it's just VR, but I feel like it put us back quite a bit. But at the same time, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because if it were 5 years later and this were all, if this was all mainstream by then, we would be able to kind of go, you know, move our way forward as a society in VR, being able to work in VR, send our kids to school, do normal meetings and in conference rooms, and just really be able to utilize the platform for what it is. And, you know, a lot of people think it's really, it kind of segregates you and sets you apart. But really it's such an amazing platform for everyone to be able to get together that can't normally fly all over the place to physically get together, and bring things closer together and just more, you know, unity. But at the same time, really bad timing of this whole COVID thing, of course. Right.
And to Kent's point, when he said, that right now, you know, you still have to kind of be well off to be able to access it. I feel like the same could be said for every single emergent technology that changed our lives, you know, like
cell phones,
TVs, even regular phones, right? Like regular phones. Yeah. Not everybody had one in the beginning. TVs, not everybody was sold in the beginning. Eventually, everybody had that shit, you know, cell phones and pagers, PCs. When I got my first PC, I wasn't mine. My dad brought that shit home. And I remember sending emails to my friends in like third grade or something, and I'm changing the font and thinking it's like the coolest thing in the entire world. Not everybody had email at that time, you know, so not everyone has VR at home now, but I do feel like it will follow suit in the way that a lot of these emergent technologies have implemented into, our lives societally.
Yeah, and I agree with that sort of technology diffusion argument, where you do need to have like things that are a certain price, and then you get economies of scale and it reaches out. I guess my deeper point is that, you know, we're in the midst of a situation where there's a significant number of people who just aren't working at all, and on like the brinks of like potential like societal economic
collapse.
So to me, I think I'm trying to like cast that larger context to really think about, like, you know, if we were to design for 5 to 10 years from now, like a whole economy that's based upon virtual exchange, if this doesn't have some sort of, you know, I do think there's going to be contact tracing and other things that we're able to potentially mitigate it if we just look to see what's happening in South Korea. But, you know, this could be that we're entering an era of the next like 40 years where there'll be the next virus. And so I think it sort of depends on some of those things of what happens. But, when we move into these new worlds that we're able to create, it's an opportunity to do a bit of like greenfield of development. So in sort of terms of IT, I've worked at Puppet for IT automation, and they would talk about brownfield and greenfield technology solutions. So the brownfield would be the legacy systems that you have to try to upgrade in some ways. And the greenfield is that you have less limitations and you're able to build something just from scratch. So VR is so new that it has the capability of building something that's completely new, but you're still in some ways dealing with the brownfield legacy of all the other inequalities. And so how do you, over the long term, design something for the next 5, 10, 20 years that has everybody involved? And then I think a big part of that is this dialectic between closed and open platforms. Like, I think at the beginning, you need to have this closed platform to be able to create the quality of experience from the Quest. But eventually you're going to need to have like more open platforms that don't necessarily take 30% of every transaction that happens. Because if we really want to use this as the next computing platform, then you need to create other solutions that don't just create it. So what's essentially happened on your mobile phones is that you have Android and iPhone. In order to do any sort of commerce through those platforms, then either Apple or Google gets to take a big cut of that. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to have an open platform where, you know, the PC didn't go that way, where like, if you buy something on Amazon, you don't have to pay a single company like a cut of that because they give you a platform. And so what I'd like to see in the long run is to see more of these open platform approaches so that we can start these more vibrant open ecosystems of the metaverse, and, you know, find ways to kind of blend the two realities of the virtual world as well as the world that we live in the physical reality. And I hope that there's still continues to be a balance between those two and that we're still connected, but that if we think about what is the future of the experiential economy going to look like, then we have to like think about like, okay, well, how does, what does an experiential economy look like that includes everybody? And it gives people opportunities to participate in making a living and doing that.
Well, I'm going to be honest, man. One of, like, I think the single biggest bummer of this whole state of the world right now for me is the fact that OC7 is not going to be happening in person. Like, I had so much fun at that conference, dude. I was like with my people, and I would have found you in the halls and chased you down and thrown a microphone in your face. And now I don't get to have that experience. But so right now, a lot of people, you know, are like screaming out, hey, this is the time, VR conferences. And I think you're probably the person, maybe the person with the most amount of VR conference visits, I'd be willing to guess. And I know you've been to a handful of conferences now in VR.
Tipitat Shivashan has me beat just because he, you know, is a VC and he flies all over the world for a lot more. I don't know anybody else that's gone to more than Tipitat. So, but I'm probably there at number two or three, probably number two, but you know, it's not a competition, but you know, because I have gone to a lot of conferences, you know, to me, I'm just grateful that I'm alive and that I can have my patrons support me. I think, a lot of what I've been looking at lately has been going to these virtual conferences and trying to, you know, see what is going to be the future of meeting online. And I do think that it's going to be possible to have that same type of feeling of being able to run into people.
Can you elaborate on the current state of VR conferences? Because you've been to a handful now.
Yeah, I recently watched one where you were in Engage at the Educators VR conference, and I thought it was great. And you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I mean, VR conferences, all these virtual conferences, people have been looking at trying to translate the content into, you know, essentially like live streams of video. And those live streams of video, you can basically just watch on YouTube or Twitch or whatever 2D streaming platform. And it's arguably a better experience to do it that way. So first was there was the Immersive Education Summit that had a number of talks in Altspace, then the Engage, there was the HTC Ecosystem Conference that happened in Engage, then the IEEE VR happened in Mozilla Hubs, which was like a big academic conference that basically took the exact same schedule and just put it into VR. And then Laval Virtual just happened, it usually happens in France, and they took the talks and some of the other aspects of kind of gathering in virtual spaces, and put it into Virbella, the platform. So I'd say that there's ways to schedule conferences where you create scheduled events for people to go talk, and then people go to those talks, and then there's the hallways where people get to the talks, and it allows people to commit to set aside their schedule and to be there and be fully present. And because of that, it gathers a community in the sense that they're open for possibility, they're open for collisions, they're open for being able to chat. I mean, that's been the bread and butter of what I've been able to do with the Voices of VR. And for me, the magic was just hanging out in those hallways and having those conversations, conversation after conversation.
Same, dude. Same.
So the way to recreate that feeling of being able to have chance encounters, I think it gets to, like, you almost have to design for that from the ground up. And almost like for me, when I'm going to conferences, I don't go to any sessions. I just spend my entire time doing the unconference. Like, I create my own track.
Same. Yep. Yep.
And
exactly.
So for me, it's a lot about the art of a serendipitous collision. And so I've sort of, over the last 6 years, been really trying to cultivate, like, what are the components of that serendipitous collision, and how do you, and I think it's, I haven't seen any, I've had experiences of collisions, but I feel like the future is going to be trying to create virtual worlds that are symbolically representing of the topics you want to talk about. So if you want to talk about automobiles and VR, there's, let's say, automobiles in the virtual world, but also symbolic representations of some of the issues that you may want to talk about.
Maybe like a Reddit in VR, and you can just warp into the worlds of the subreddits that you want to go into or whatever.
Well, it'd be more like if you were going to like a coffee shop, but the coffee shop was a meetup for everybody that's interested in the metaverse.
Right.
Maker's Mixer that I've been going to, and it's great. It's like a meetup or birds of a feather where, you know, there's this, to get back to the philosophical aspects, you know, Aristotle would talk about the four different causes. And one of the causes was the final causation. And the final causation was this like intentional field that was going to be driving you towards a specific like outcome. So what's the goal? Like, so like if you have a table, maybe the table is to like eat on, or, like the eventual purpose for why something exists. And so when you're gathering together, you're setting an intentional field for people to, you know, the way I think about it, at least, is that you have your own intentions for what you want to do. And you get together with a bunch of other people who have their own intentions, but you can't succeed in accomplishing your intentions alone. You need to find other people who can help accomplish your intentions. And so mm-hmm. a lot of those magical serendipitous collisions they happen when those intentional fields collide with each other, and you're able to kind of create something that you weren't able to create on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so
and don't you in a way like almost like validate each other's intentions by like observing them, you know, like, because now you have others observing your intentions and contributing to the existence of it.
Yeah. I think it's certainly validating, and it sometimes reveals things you didn't know. There was a thing that that you had posted, which was the Kent by the voices of VR, and I had a little bit of disagreement. And
yeah,
part of it is because my sort of primary orientation is in more of a relational metaphysics or a process philosophy, where I tend to see myself in relationship to the ecosystem around me, and that I can't succeed in understanding anything on my own. Like, there's language and a whole history and lineage of humankind for thousands and thousands of years, with many generations that have been able to, I'm standing on the shoulders of all those giants to be able to even comprehend what the nature of reality even is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to be less focused on, you know, myself as an individual, and seeing that it's like I'm fundamentally interconnected and interdependent upon other people. And just the counteraction of the existing metaphysical assumptions of reality right now is substance metaphysics, meaning that like the primary fabric of all reality is stuff. It's like the physicality of reality. And Alfred North Whitehead was he's a mathematician at the turn of the century. He was seeing what Einstein was doing about with space-time, with general relativity. And he saw that he was really like, the space-time continuum was really being put into like this substance metaphysics of like this fixed object. It's almost like the universe is this deterministic loaf of bread, and that like everything's already happened, and that you're just sort of with this fadedness of just moving through the world. And he was learning about both the you know, his mathematical understanding of that. He was into mathematics, but also mathematical physics specifically, but he had problems philosophically with that. And he actually got into, from mathematics into philosophy to be able to start to develop a whole other metaphysical framework, which ended up being, what people refer to as process philosophy. And he also was looking at quantum mechanics and seeing how the underlying quanta of energy was like more of these potentials, what he eventually called these happenings or events. So if you think about the particle wave duality, it's almost like the particle is the stuff. It's like the collapsing of the wave function into a concrete object. Mm-hmm. But there's also the wave of possibilities, which is like a probabilistic wave of potential. But he tended to see that as a more of a function of time, or an event that was happening over time. And so he would say that the underlying nature of reality were these processes, these actual entities, and these the unfolding of processes. And so and rather than saying that the underlying nature of reality is fixed stuff, he's saying that it's like this dynamic flux that's constantly changing. And when you start to orient yourself around this flux that's constantly changing, then it has all these other implications, which is that you tend to see consciousness as a part of a participation in a consciousness that's unfolding, and maybe even a larger consciousness. You know, one of the things that Whitehead was pushing forward was a philosophy of a consciousness of panpsychism, which was that like every single bit of every quanta, every photon, every electron had some level of consciousness to it, and that when you added them together, it was almost like this pool of water that would integrate, and somehow it would start to have more complexity to it. And so Tononi has like this way of looking at how to integrate all those different aspects of consciousness to get deeper levels of consciousness. So rather than saying that consciousness is an epiphenomena of our physicality, if you deny that the physicality is the base reality, and you say that maybe there's something deeper of a field of being or a field of experience, then rather than consciousness being emergent, then it's something that's actually fundamental. It's like the base layer of reality is some level of consciousness, and that it's more of like more akin to seeing like your body more as an antenna that's receiving a consciousness signal, rather than saying that your brain, or your whole body through embodied cognition is having the data there. It'd almost be like if you were streaming Netflix and you tried to hack into your TV looking for the code of the TV signal when actually it's being streamed over the internet and it's kind of like coming in. That's like one model of consciousness. I mean, there's many different models of consciousness, but it's right. A metaphor that I think about to sort of get out of just thinking in terms of physical stuff into more of these other kind of process relational approach.
You know, I have for a long time kind of attached to the former of the two perspectives that you were just giving us there, the whole like playing out of physical objects ultimately resulting in self-awareness. And that's something that I've really entertained for a long time. And for me, it's easy to like see like the unfolding of that, you know, like if you agree that the Big Bang happened, it sets off into all these fundamental physical laws, and eventually the dominoes become so complex they start realizing that they're there and they're asking, well, what the hell is all of this? You know, but I haven't really heard a lot of like examples of the other of the former, of like the consciousness being inherent. And I almost wonder if like the spark of consciousness that developed as a result of the playing out of the physical objects is in of itself like the same point as the beginning. And it's almost this like conundrum kind of thing, right? Where like you go back in time to teach yourself the thing that made you go crazy, and it's this like weird kind of loop, and you're just experiencing it from a subjective perspective somewhere along the line. You know what I mean?
Well, the challenge with consciousness is that there's many different theories, because you can't know for sure. There's like no way to falsify right. and test it. So because it is like, could you prove that you have a phenomenal experience? I mean, how would you prove it?
Yeah. You can't prove anything. You can't prove shit. That's why we keep talking about it for thousands of years.
The only proof is that you know you have it. Or do you? Or is it an illusion? I mean, you can't even prove that.
What is it? René Descartes?
Well, yeah, he was talking about like, you know, sort of like this evil genius, and that, you know, what if this evil genius was sort of producing all these different aspects of consciousness? But there's the illuminative materialists like Daniel Dennett and other folks who just say that, yeah, all the consciousness is just, you know, the physical matter of, you know, there's the two main fields of the naturalists who say that the only aspects of reality are the things that the physical things that we can actually measure. So there's a bit of a boundedness there. And when you look at the other side, is the more idealism, which is like, maybe there's stuff that's like beyond space time. Like there's a transcendent realm beyond space and time. And so the quantum mechanics has a math structure of an infinite dimension Hilbert space. And somehow that infinite dimension Hilbert space like collapses down into like 3D reality. Or maybe it doesn't collapse. Maybe this is what the naturalists believe. It's more of the Everett interpretation of the many worlds of quantum mechanics, where it's actually like a bunch of naturalistic worlds in parallel side by side, and that the wave function never collapses and that you just have all these parallel realities side by side. So the challenge with looking at the difference between the naturalistic approach versus the, you know, idealistic approach of saying that there is something that's transcendent beyond space and time is that you can't, how would you test something that's beyond space and time? Like, how do you know? And this sort of gets back to like the perennial philosophy of math question as to whether or not math objects are invented or discovered. You know, are they, is there something that's already there that is having some sort of causal influence with reality, you know, from a formal causation perspective, from an Aristotelian perspective, that like, you know, Eugene Wigner said that there's an unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Like the mathematical equations, like they work a little bit too well. Like quantum electrodynamics has like a precision to like 13 decimal points. So if math was just a language that's created by and invented by humans, then why would it have a level of precision that is that precise? There seems to be something else that might be going on. But again, this gets to these, some of these questions as to like, there's no way to know for sure. And so that's why it remains a philosophical question, is because you can take both sides and argue both sides and still have legitimate arguments, but you'll still really never really know.
Right. Well, and I guess that's why this is so much damn fun, because ultimately, like, it's like the game that never ends, right? Like, you know, or the movie that just like, you never get that conclusion. It's like the carrot, like we're just chasing this thing. And what for you is the inherent value in continuing to just like dig and pull away the layers?
Well, so I like to point to Gödel and his incompleteness theorem, because are you guys familiar with the incompleteness theorem at all?
No, sir.
Okay. So Gödel was a mathematician, and it was actually, you know, this, he was responding to this effort to be able to try to convert all of mathematics into logic. And so this is something that actually Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead were trying to do with the Principia Mathematica, was trying to reduce all of mathematics into this language of logic. And so Gödel came along and he basically proved that that's a failed effort. You can't do that, because any consistent set of logic is going to have one of two mutually exclusive characteristics. It's either going to be complete or consistent. So if you're complete, then there's going to be, well, if you try to be consistent, which is what mathematicians try to do, then it's going to be incomplete, meaning there's going to always be new mathematics created until the heat death of the universe, because it's never going to be done. It's going to be incomplete, but at least it's consistent. But if you try to be complete, then there's going to be paradoxes and inconsistencies that you have to try to resolve. And so the thing that inspired Gödel was that he was somebody who believed in God, and he wanted to prove that if you had a logical system, that there'd be things that you know are true, but you can't prove are true within your logical system. So he took that as a catalyst to be able to basically prove that mathematically.
That sounds like quite the challenge.
That any sort of like consistent logic is going to have things that are outside of that logic that transcends your ability to be able to comprehend or see it. And that's why I think a lot of mathematicians turn towards pluralism, which is that you kind of change these contexts, and based upon your axioms, you kind of use the tools that are available, but you don't necessarily try to come up with a comprehensive, like, you know, the foundations of mathematics. There isn't a single unified like theory of like the foundational, you know, there's a lot of approaches for that, but there's a lot of still debate around what math is and why it works. But that lesson, Bonnie Gold told me that, you know, philosophy is like a spotlight. It gives you like this opinionated perspective as to what the nature of reality is. And then you can go test it. Like for Gödel, he wanted to test to see if he could kind of mathematically prove something else. And that, to me, that's one of the most revelatory like philosophical discoveries. Other people would have never thought to even look for it. They just like, it wasn't even on the radar to be able to try to do that. But Gödel was inspired by his philosophy to go look and do something. So I feel like actually virtual reality is going to be a perfect opportunity for people to have a very strong philosophical opinion about something and then to be able to actually go out and test it. And because they're coming from that different perspective, they may be able to take an approach to VR that is just completely different than anybody else. And that's a big reason why I think it's so important to really encourage a diversity of lots of different people from different perspectives, different backgrounds, different philosophical orientations to be able to get involved in the medium, because that will just in the end produce way more better experiences that we'll learn stuff from, because they're coming up with an approach of doing stuff that we would never imagine.
Mm-hmm. I love it. You know, I talked earlier about how, you know, VR in its current state is kind of like a rough manipulation of sensory perception organs that we have. And I often like to entertain the thought of like the shit that's flying around in the room right now that we don't have sensory perception organs for. Like, you know, earlier you spoke about people who talk about that naturalist philosophy where it's like the only thing that's real is the matter that we're able to perceive and interact with. Do you ever entertain the idea that there's like shit floating around in the room that we don't have the ear for or the way to perceive?
Oh, we know that's true already. I mean, there's lots of stuff that's here that we can't see. I mean, whether it's electromagnetic waves or whatnot. I mean, a big question is like, to what degree can we
transfer? Well, I guess the question then for me would be like, if we were able to perceive it, you know, in what ways do you think that would influence, you know, the way that we perceive reality as a whole? And do you see the future of VR finding new ways to unlock that type of potential?
Well, there's a concept called sensory addition and sensory substitution, which is that, so sensory substitution is to take an existing sense, like your hearing, and you would like take like say a haptic vest and translate all the input that's coming in and translate it into your body, and then send the same signals that your body would usually send to your cochlea, but to kind of reroute it through your body, your torso. So the neosensory vest from David Eagleman does this, and did an interview, and he was like, we're turning your torso into an ear. Now, how much does what you hear sound like what you would hear if you came from the ear? I'm sure it's going to be different, but it's still like your brain is plastic enough to be able to listen and understand. The concept of sensory addition means that you can start to cultivate your senses for stuff that you couldn't perceive before. So one example is like this North Pole, which is that you put a device on your ankle and it kind of every 5 minutes it's pinging you as to where true north is. So you start to cultivate like your subtle awareness of shadows, the time of day, and then just you start to orient yourself to the world of where northeast, south is, and you're able to have that cardinal direction, intuitive sense that you're able to cultivate in yourself, or you're able to perhaps start to perceive electromagnetic waves. I mean, there's been lots of experience of biohackers who've been starting to experiment with this, but if you break that apart philosophically, what it means is that like if our lived experience is a big part of taking in our sensory input, and that defines the bounds of our sensory experience of our human experience. What happens when you start to increase the level of input that you're putting into your body and able to, I think the key thing also is to create the multimodal correlations between that. So you're able to do sonification to data visualization, or you're able to sort of cross over and almost create these synesthetic type of experiences where you start to, hear color and see sounds and have different aspects of how your sensory input starts to mash together. So I think that's a bit of an inevitability of where we're going and starting to, let's say, train yourself to be an octopus avatar where you're able to take the neural inputs and map it to the virtual entity. And then you're able to basically have an expression that you're able to train yourself to be an octopus. Kind of putting all these different sensors on yourself. So, yeah, I think it's
how do you see all of this changing once we get deep into the brain interfacing part of VR that everyone's really working on. I feel like this is this is going to be, I feel like it's a kind of a hard thing to answer, right? But you know, well, give it a shot.
this actually gets into the nature of consciousness and the degree to which that you could sort of bypass our sensory input. Or I'm personally somewhat skeptical. I mean, I know that there's going to be some stuff that you're going to be able to, you know, do. And what's going to happen is going to start with people with neurodegenerative conditions. So people who are already to the point where whatever type of they have nothing to lose because their life is already at the point where
that makes sense
so quickly that they're more open to be able to experiment with these types of more invasive procedures of putting neural meshes into your brain. And I do think that they're going to be able to have these, they're going to modulate the experience to some degree. Now, I think there's a question of efficiency here in terms of, like, for one, can you bypass the sensory experience? And can you bypass, like, the conceptual model and framework that is, a key component of the way that we're perceiving? And can you bypass our embodied cognition? Like, a lot of people, when they start to think about these types of neural laces, they don't realize that our entire body is a sensory input. And so by sort of injecting stuff directly into the brain, you're kind of like rewriting the source code of a computer without going through the proper ways of really integrating it.
Mm-hmm. And Andrea Iancochicoru, who I know you have had conversations with on Twitter, I think you've had conversations with her on podcasts and stuff. We had her on the show earlier in the season, and she talked about how, the hardware is like integral to the software, like how the hardware is almost like defined by the sensory input.
Yeah, I think you can't separate them. And I think that people who do try to separate them are falling to like the trappings of reductive materialism, which is that they're trying to create this artificial split. Now, again, this may be a test to see, like, maybe this will provide confirmatory evidence that, you know, the way that our brain works is like maybe they'll get some deep insight to the nature of consciousness and they will find one way or another. But I suspect that it's entirely possible that this venture of trying to do that is just going to completely fail because you have to have your ability to record information and moments and data. You know, maybe there's a way, you know, one of the things that David Eagleman was saying is that they wanted to be able to like subconsciously like feed stock market data into your body, which, by the way, I think is a horrible thing that I would never want to do.
Yeah.
If I want to like have data be put into my body, I want it to be connecting me to like what's happening around me. I don't want it to be an abstraction of this thing. But if you were a stock trader, then can you start to feed information into your body and then you start to unconsciously learn it? Because some of the things that he was talking about was the neosensory ability to be able to allow to turn your torso into an ear, it kind of learns slowly each day. It's almost like playing Beat Saber. You can't just like jump in Beat Saber and then automatically go to Expert Plus. And then you know, it's like your body has to integrate all those. You have to do it day in and day out. And so they have found some evidence that you can start to feed information into your body and it kind of like it's like unconscious learning, which is like, what does that even mean in terms of navigate this process of kind of dumping data into your body to the point where you're trying to like cultivate different aspects of learning. So is it going to be like that where, you know, well, for Neo, he wakes up and he's like, I know Kung Fu. Well,
right.
Is it going to be like, yeah, you know, the essence of the structure of the Kung Fu, but you still need to like do the practice.
You still need to practice
in order to really integrate it. You may like, so that's, I have a hard time believing that like, I feel like it's going to be able to do some stuff, but it's going to be limited and it might be more limited than people expect that kind of fall into this way of thinking of our brains as a machine. When in reality, our brains are all entire bodies, maybe that machine, or maybe it's just like a receptor, like an antenna. That's like a completely different model of what consciousness even is. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes, and maybe we'll get more information. Either way, I think we're going to get more information. But I feel like there's something about this that's going to be fundamentally like mysterious. But that, like for me, I think there's more encouraging evidence to go towards using our existing sensory input, which has evolved over like billions of years to be very sophisticated.
Yeah.
Why not use that?
Yeah, sure. And you know, there's a lot of really, really smart people working on this right now. You know, Gabe Newell and you know, Facebook has taken some interest and purchased a company for brain interfacing. I feel like maybe this is
those are neural inputs, which is a little bit different than sometimes of like the neural lace of like injecting stuff in your brain. So
right. But that's where they want to go.
Well, you know, I don't know. We'll see how invasive some of these things are. I know that
Neuralink, for example, they have a way of injecting the wires into your brain and using this machine that can go around, you know, all the major blood vessels as to not kill you. But you know, everyone's really going to be pushing for that wireless thing. And I know Gabe has spoke a lot about being able to wirelessly write to the brain as well. And I feel like this is, you know, in a different world, in a different time, that might be a good thing. But in a world that is controlled by corporations and advertising and you know, that's all about your data, might not be a good thing. What are your thoughts on that?
And before we get too far away, there is something that I kind of wanted to ask that's very much in relation to something that you just asked. But you said, you know, if our sensory perception is like so sophisticated, why would you worry about passing over that? But I feel like I would do it for the same reason that I would try to learn how to lucid dream. You know, like now that I have the foundation and I can play with that, you know, and if I'm able to master lucid dreaming, then I can shift through realities and have the experiences as if they are the same ones that I have with my normal sensory perception to the brain. There really isn't any difference in those experiences when you're actually experiencing those things, you know. So I often like to entertain the Black Mirror thing with like the little pebble that they put on their temple and knock out, you know. It's almost like entering a lucid dream, and those experiences are super, super profound. And to me, that sounds like a fucking good time. Sounds like fun.
I think that actually there's a really compelling use case for people who are blind or deaf, and you know, in terms of giving access to be able to restore sight, or, you know, there's a whole culture of people who are deaf who don't want to have cochlear implants, but there is like things that you can implant into your brain and learn how to hear. It sort of modulates that. And so is there something similar to that for sight? I know there's a number of people that I've are working on that, and I've interviewed some. And so, yeah, I think there's aspects of, so we do have dreams, right? And there could be a function of dreams, but then what happens when other people are editing or controlling your dreams? Maybe there's like good reasons for you to not have any interference with that. Maybe there's a deeper process that you're tapping in there with the function of dreams, which could be to try to like go over the course of the day and rewrite things. And so I guess that's part of my response, which is that when you start to kind of turn it into a grand adventure that you're in control of, well, maybe that's actually something that is better suited to be completely out of control and out of anything messing with in any way. So we don't know what the real ultimate, you know, sort of the philosophy of dreams, or what are dreams and what are they for? Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of them? And I think that's a lot of work of what Carl Jung
but don't you think this could get us closer to that?
And isn't that the same question ultimately that philosophy is asking? You know, like, what's it for anyway? Like, why are we even doing all of this? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's a grand adventure like that where we can just make the decisions to do whatever we want. But I feel like you could argue that that is in essence the typical human experience. That's our lives that we're experiencing now. I could go run down the street naked right now if I felt like it, you know. I deal with the consequences that typically exist in this reality, but that's another reason why I might want to learn how to lucid dream or experience something that like surpasses everything, because then I wouldn't have to deal with the typical consequences that normally result as a result of that kind of behavior.
Well, a philosopher that I draw a lot of inspiration from secondary interpretations of him, because it's very difficult to actually read directly, but Hegel and his concept of the dialectics and the polarities. And so having this thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And so a lot of the approach that I take at looking at a lot of these different questions is trying to look at the polar extremes of like, if you have the extreme of like, just say, complete going all in and becoming a cyborg and injecting all of this technology, being a biohacker, and just going all in of hacking your consciousness to the biggest extent you can. And then the other extreme is going to be like the Luddites, who are just like, you know, not even well, I guess there's going to be a bifurcation between invasive and non-invasive. We could just like start there, because I do think that people are going to use the technology in non-invasive ways, and that's less controversial. But I think what is controversial is the invasive,
for sure,
be able to actually inject things into your body. And what it reminds me of is things like Monsanto, which they start to go in there and start to genetically engineer seeds. And then they have these unintended consequences where, oh, all of a sudden there's like a colony collapse of bees, or
right.
They may not even imagine that there could be a connection there. But that's my hesitation of like going in and doing all this invasive stuff into our body and our neurology, is that we have no idea of these complex systems. We don't even really fully understand. And now we're going in and like being mechanics of this system. Like, it's almost like this arrogance of like thinking that we're going to be able to control like things that are beyond our control. And what I worry is that there's going to, you know, have these unintended consequences that are going to have these other negative side effects. And so as I think about the dialectics here, I think that, you know, I think this is sort of the essence of the philosophy, is that there's these ethical questions that, like, there's no clear ethical line on a lot of that stuff. There's not like a clear cost benefit analysis that has objectified numbers. That's very clear that you could just take a utilitarian approach and just like add up all the numbers and figure out what's best. It's like the ethics doesn't work like that. It's never that clear. It's always, if you get something, you're losing something else.
Right.
The philosophical approach to this is to see, okay, what are you giving up when you start to go down this road? And for me, it's like the potential of the unintended consequences of what we can't even imagine, because there have been enough longitudinal studies over many generations to see how that's going to shift things.
Well, it's so interesting how we connect consciousness to the brain almost specifically, because if you think about it, we've been like injecting technology into people to keep them alive or to enhance their lives for a long time by using prosthetics or, you know, like pacemakers or like whatever. And, you know, it's almost like no one cares about the potential unintended bad consequences of keeping people alive who should probably be dead. But because we have the technology to do so, we keep them alive and we keep them up and kicking, you know. But like, it's almost like the brain is this, like, there's almost this like moral thing that's connected to diving into that specific organ. And when, you know, I guess we haven't even ultimately defined that consciousness exists there specifically, you know, like you are your whole body.
The one thing that I do know is that it's not just in the brain, it's in the entire body.
Right.
So I'm totally resistant to like assigning to the brain of thinking about consciousness. It is an embodied experience. It's not only distributed throughout your whole body, but it's arguably distributed throughout the entire world,
right.
World that we are associating, and our memories being associated, being connected there. So, so that's one thing. But I think there's no thing that you do that doesn't have any potential unintended risk. I mean, even if you're doing all those procedures, it could potentially be life threatening, or yours. You know, for people like for the cochlear implant, there's a whole documentary where people who got the cochlear implant, like there's an ability to be able to get a device that basically allows you to hear again, but there's some families who are deaf who don't want their children to have. And the question is why? Well, part of the reason why is that there's a whole culture that comes about because of the certain ways in which they communicate. And that once you start to put that device in, then that sort of disrupts the normal culture in the way of communicating. And so they're just like any of these different things, there are going to be those different, you know, trade-offs that may not be immediately obvious, but there are, like with all this stuff, it's not like you're gaining stuff, but you're also losing stuff. And so what are you losing?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it's like butterfly effect shit, you know. It's like they say that the butterfly flaps its wings, causes a typhoon on the other side of the planet. But it's like, you know, we might not even be able to recognize or measure the effect that, you know, keeping grandpa alive with the pacemaker or whatever is having, you know. But like, just by continuing to have his energy contribute to the collective consciousness, when, you know, ultimately nature would have swept him away by now, had it not been for our technological achievements and advancements, you know, like we may never be able to even see that it happens on the other side of the planet because of the domino effect that happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's a lot of complex nonlinear systems that are interacting with virtual reality. And the one of the books that I've read recently was The Dynamics of Transformation by Grant Maxwell, which he's really trying to break down all of the different parts of like what is going to constitute like this paradigm shift that we could be going through. And one of them is this exponential rates of change, which we've in the era of coronavirus where, we've had this direct experience of another thing he talks, which is like this discontinuous shift where all of a sudden you're in one reality. Now you're in a new reality. That happened after 9/11. And that happened after mm-hmm. we all went under quarantine. It was like, okay, this is our new reality. And then there's a whole new set of rules that happen. Well, that's very similar to like other aspects of paradigm shifts where there's a punctuated equilibrium where things are kind of going around at a certain pace. And then all of a sudden you do this like discontinuous jump and now you're in a new reality. Mm-hmm. That's how a lot of evolution works. But that shift from one to the next, you can also kind of think of it as the hockey stick of an exponential curve going where the doubling gets to the point where it kind of reaches yep. out into the culture.
I talk about this all the time, dude. Like I always use like, it's almost like just like the gaps between claps, you know, it's like for thousands of years, people would exist and not see shit. Like there was no technological advancements. Like grandma came, great grandma, great, great, great grandma. And like, you know, they just didn't see shit, but we're at the point now where like, we're starting to see it, like you said, exponentially grow. And like the parabola is getting closer and closer to that line. And each time we check back in, the gap is doubling. So we're at this point now where like the claps were like this, but then they get faster, 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 and it's about to go and take off. And it's like, I'm not even sure that we're even remotely capable of grasping the way that that is going to manifest.
Well, I think if you only focus on the technology, that may be true. But if you focus on the human experience changes a lot slower. And there's a lot more ways that you can look at different aspects of the human experience and have a lot better sense of how our lives are going to change. Because I think you can break up the different contexts that we have in our lives, whether it's our home and family, what we do for entertainment, getting medical care, our relationships that we have, ways of dealing with death and grieving, or concepts of philosophy and spirituality and religion and higher education and what we do for work, how we hang out with our friends, dealing with isolation or feeling like we're having to come through different difficult times and grief of our lives, the identity expression that we have, our money and our finances, the way that we communicate, our early education, all of those things are like domains of human experience that are pretty set, pretty consistent, and that you can start to look at how the technology is going to start to potentially mediate these different things, but that there seems to be a consistency there of the contexts of our lives, but also the quality of our experiences, whether that's through the mental and social presence, active presence, embodied presence, emotional presence, the modulation of all those different ingredients that constitute different aspects of an experience, but also the character of, you know, whether you're exploring different aspects of your fear or guilt or love or justice or truth or beauty, you know, all these sort of primitive archetypal expressions of the, you know, the passions, mm-hmm. the virtues. These are the archetypal character that we're embodying as we get into these different experiences. And so I feel like those are pretty set, pretty consistent of how those unfold. We've got a pretty good sense of those things, but what VR does is it gives us new access into those things to be able to modulate those different, you know, to create these synthetic simulations of these, but also to potentially expand into different things that we've never been able to do before. But I tend to not look at the change through the lens of the technology alone, in isolation of looking at it through the lens of the human, because as I'm a process philosopher, but also a phenomenologist, more than an analytic philosophy. And so I tend to look at things through the direct experience, the direct embodied experience of these things, and to see that there's a little bit more consistency rather than, you can get overwhelmed with trying to imagine the complex of all these things adding together, but you get a better sense of trying to look at it through the lens of the human. And then from there, try to see, okay, let's just focus on IoT, Internet of Things at the home with artificial intelligence, and what are the things you want to do at home? What are the things you want to be able to bring in your friends and be able to, you know, navigate the area of that you have physically so that you can meld those realities onto other layers of reality, and then, you know, maybe even have a layers of virtual reality on top of that. But, you know, there's certain things that you want to do, like you want to have a game, you want to connect to your family, you want to explore, you know, these things that are more consistent. And then if you look at it through that lens, then you can have a lot better sense of how all these technologies are going to come together.
Mm-hmm. I love it, man. This is so good. How you doing, Skiva?
I'm pretty good, man. I feel like I'm just sitting here. I'm just so enthralled with this conversation that I almost forget that I'm half the host of this podcast. Just, oh, yeah. I wish I could say this.
Do you have any questions, Skiva, that you wanted to throw in there that you've been, I know you've been sort of listening in?
Hey, have you?
No,
all
you
those
know.
Books behind you, Kent?
No, I haven't. No.
There's a bunch of books back
there's
there.
There's a bunch of books. It's only a fraction. I'm very ambitious with books that I want to read, and sometimes I'll dive into them, and I've got other bookshelves that I read frequently, but right now, actually, the Powell's bookstore is shut down, and for a while, I was going into conferences and then buying books related to that. So I feel like I've stocked up. If like I don't buy any more books in my lifetime, I have enough books to kind of last me. But there's lots of stuff that, like, I don't know. There's way more stuff that I have a very big curiosity, but I've also learned that a lot of the way that I learn actually is by having conversations, and listening to people and being engaged. And so, a lot of times that'll give me a good sense of a domain and a field, cause I've actually gone then to two math conferences and talked about the philosophy of math. I've gone to a philosophy conference, talked to philosophers. I've gone to like four or five different artificial intelligence conferences and, two different decentralized web conferences and lots of different conferences about consciousness and esoteric topics. So I've just, my primary mode of learning is through the art of conversation. But I have been diving into different books as well.
If I had if my backlog of games was in physical form, it would probably resemble what you've got going on there. And I think it's the same where it's like, I could probably never buy another fucking video game in my life and be fine. Like, I think I have enough at this point to just keep going, but I can't stop, man. Like, they keep coming out and I got to get in there. I want to experience all these worlds and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know what I want to ask you, Kent, is, you know, we're dipping into a weird time here, right? So we're the closest we've ever been to being able to change our consciousness stream and be able to go places without actually going anywhere. You talked a lot about ethics in VR, and I feel like it's a really sketchy and crazy subject to even think about, because, you know, we talk about things like brain interfacing and just, you know, even eye tracking, right? Being companies and stuff being able to tell what we're looking at, how long we're looking for, you know, looking at it, if there's brain interfacing, how we feel when we see these types of things. Do you see the abuse over some of this data kind of outshining the positives, or do you think there'll be balance, or what are your thoughts on that?
So it's a good question, because I feel like in the medical context, I don't have any problem with all of the stuff. Where I think it does start to get way more dangerous is when there's companies whose entire business model is surveillance capitalism, to be able to look at what we're looking at, what we're feeling, to be able to actually correlate that to what is happening in the virtual reality experience. You know, that's within their terms of service, to be able to take what you're looking at, take that scene and basically like associate it and create all this metadata. So, you know, there's a question in terms of what is the business model of the future? I think that is going to be one of the biggest open questions in terms of like how we continue to function as a society. Like, whenever I go to the decentralized web summit and camp, you know, I had this conversation with Vint Cerf from Google, where I was like, and Vint Cerf was one of the like co-inventors of the internet. And I was like, he's working at Google, and Google is, you know, a big proponent of surveillance capitalism. And so I was like, hey, Vint, why don't you stop doing some of that surveillance capitalism. And he's like, well, if you have a better way of giving universal access to all human knowledge to everybody in the world for free, let me know. Exactly like that. But it's essentially, that was like his argument that, you know, there's a bit of economies of scale that happen and that you do need to have some exchange. And right now that's advertising. And in order to really do that targeted advertising, then it's based upon being able to actually like target that information. And as Jaron Lanier says, like if you're communicating with somebody, then the contract we've made is that there's a company that's in between that's going to be watching everything that you're saying and doing and trying to manipulate each of you. And that's kind of the contract that we have. And I think that's a bad contract and we should change it. There is a documentary this year at Sundance called The Social Dilemma that unpacks all of this and goes into a lot of Tristan Harris's work at the Center for Humane Technologies. And it's a brilliant documentary that really, you know, casts this whole current time of surveillance capitalism. But it is a utilitarian exchange that we've made, which is that we've decided that it's more valuable for us to get stuff for free than it is to have access to our privacy. We don't know what we've lost, I don't think. I think it's still an abstraction as to what exactly that means. Mm-hmm. That they have this much information on us. And whether or not we'll have like digital doppelgangers or being able to actually like mimic us and what we would say and have like artificial intelligent bots that are able to mimic our voice and mimic all the things and have information that only they would know to be able mm-hmm. to basically use this as a threat vector to be able to like spoof our identity and to take all of our money and to, you know, basically do all the worst things of creating havoc on people. Mm-hmm. There's gonna be things about our identity that are part of our biometric signatures that we can't get back. I mean, there's emails that are out there. We can change our email, but we can't change our retinas. We can't change our fingerprints. We can't change different aspects of our bone length and our gait detection as we're walking around. We can't change different aspects of the internal parts of our body and how they're related. There may be unique fingerprints of all this biometric data, which most of the privacy angle, they have this two classes of a personally identifiable information and then basically de-identified or anonymous information. And right now everything's being treated as anonymous, but I suspect that what we're going to find is that you're able to re-engineer and unlock all that information. Mm-hmm. Imagine that you are in a virtual reality experience, you have eye tracking that you're broadcasting, and then you're able to have like an AI bot that has computer vision that's able to watch and observe you, record all of that biometric data signals, and then basically get the key, your biometric key, to be able to go in and to get any information if they hack into these computers. And imagine, like, we have this metaphor that all this data that Facebook and Google are collecting is in this like safe vault. But imagine like 5 to 10 years from now, 10 years of biometric data of everything we've said or done or experienced over the last decade of our virtual lives suddenly gets onto the dark web. And there's enough ways to unlock that information and what it means. And so you basically have this dossier of information that's out there that could be used to control and manipulate us for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like, that's not a path that we want to go down. And I think the risks of that are greater than the architectures that we have. We could be saving all of our data on our personal computers, but it's all in the cloud. And in the United States, there's the third-party doctrine, which means that any data that you give to a third party has no reasonable expectation to be private. So there's no Fourth Amendment protections to that. That means that any data that any company records, the government can come and get it. And, you know, it's also just like, if this information gets out there, what is going to be the unintended consequences of that? And mm-hmm. these are more philosophical questions right now, because it's in the future, it hasn't happened, and it's very abstract. But I think that mm-hmm. we have to think about that and think about like the different ways to architect for privacy, to do privacy engineering, to mitigate and to minimize the amount of data that we're collecting, just because, you know, there is this like hoarding of all this data and information and collecting it without having a clear purpose and having the mindset that we're going to figure it out later. There's these electronic dossiers that are being collected, and they're going to only get more sophisticated and they're going to get more information over time. And we don't really have much pushback. I mean, these companies are just doing what they want, and there's no way to push back on it. But until there's other economic models that are out there that are really facilitating a more decentralized model, then I suspect that we're going to continue to do this until, like, the incentives for violating our privacy are dissociated from the economic impact of the economic benefits, and whether that's from the U.S. government or some sort of ways of trying to have deeper privacy laws. There's a number of different privacy approaches, whether it's like a libertarian approach where you could basically own your data and license it out like copyright, whether it's like having more of a paternalistic approach from like Dr. Mina Allen, where it's like, you people don't know why this is so important, so we're going to protect it for you, which I don't think this is necessarily a good approach. And then there's something kind of in between, which is around like contextual privacy, or contextual integrity, which is like, depending on that context, then it sort of depends on how you are dealing with your privacy. But I do think that there is the need for some deeper discussion and thinking about this, and also just a consumer awareness and demands from the consumers about what they want. And to mitigate this amount of information, eventually, once there's competitors to things from Oculus, from like the Quest, and I realize that that's like the best on the market. But at the same time, there's a bit of like, you know, feeding in all of this information into this monopoly that we don't have much recourse to market dynamics. They're just going to do what they want without any accountability or transparency. It's just going to go forward without us really knowing how this is going to all play out.
You know, Sasha LeBaron, who works for Somnium Space, I know you've interviewed him. I saw you interviewing him at OC6 out in the streets at like 9 p.m. We had him on the show, and he seems to think that, you know, the AI versions of ourselves is an inevitable thing. You know, he seems to think that in the future, our kids are going to be able to interact with us because of all the biometric data that was collected and recreated with an AI. And, you know, I wonder myself if it's inevitable. And I kind of almost see that, like, it's almost more of like the inevitable gathering of as much possible data of what this whole experience is as possible. Like, you know, I'm sure that there was similar conversations to this one being had by people who were trying to like map the earth, you know, like the cartographers, like, you know, getting chased off by natives who are like trying to just like write, you know, jot it all out and put this whole picture together. You know, and then Google basically maps the entire planet. It doesn't ask anybody's, you know, they don't ask anybody's permission if they can photograph their backyards, but your backyard's on fucking Google Maps, guarantee it, you know? So it's like, it's almost like this like inevitable gathering of as much data as possible to like put the big picture together and use it for our benefit. Like, what would you say to an argument like that?
Well, I mean, there's trade-offs. There's certainly, there's going to be amazing things that, you're going to be able to do. Like, I love Google Maps. I love being able to get around. I love to go to a place where I don't know anything and be able to still use all that information to get around. But I guess it gets down to like, what do you want to experience, and why are you doing this? Why do you want to like recreate somebody's consciousness in AI? Like what purpose? And I think what I would say is that there's always going to be a level of technical debt. So, but it gets back to actually Gödel and this incompleteness. It's like, it's going to be incomplete or inconsistent. So it's not going to be your entire consciousness. That's going to be impossible, because only there's going to be certain aspects of your phenomenal experience that is completely ineffable and not even be able to be traceable by any external mechanism. But it also could potentially just be wrong and get things just not right, which happens quite a lot. I mean, machine learning has got very susceptible to, you know, adversarial networks and, you know, noise, to be able to look at what the threshold is and, you know, to really manipulate these in ways that are imperceptible from a human. So I don't think it's inevitable that we're going to create these digital doppelgangers in AI. I think it's an extremely hard problem, and that we're going to certainly try, but I feel like what's more likely is that the AI is going to be in service of specific problems, like the assistant to be able to like help train and educate your child. And so rather than trying to like replicate the nature of your of who you are. Like there's going to be like, there's companies that are already trying to do that through, oral histories and be able to have, allow you to have conversations. I think there's a compelling reason to that, but it's edited. It's like 20 hours. It's not like, you know, how would you bound something like trying to recreate someone's consciousness? And how would you have a model that would account for a process orientation, which is mean that it would continue to evolve over time? I think that that's going to be maybe a less, you know, important thing to try to solve than maybe other things first. Maybe there'll be a creative storytelling aspect.
Or it's possible that that's like that, just that won't be the most beneficial perspective to view this whole thing from, you know, like maybe, you know, our understanding of the way the nature of all of this will expand to the point where like, that's like, you know, that's like, you know, like the 1950s sketches when they were like trying to imagine what the future would be like. And there's people out there and like hang gliders delivering pizzas on tall windows, you know, like they're not, didn't quite get it, you know, because they had such a limited perspective to view all of it from. So, you know, it might manifest, like I've kind of said earlier, in a way that we just, you know, haven't even been ready to comprehend. And it's only when we cross that threshold that we're going to have the knowledge that we need to start coming to some conclusions on some of this stuff, you know?
Yeah, I tend to compare computing technologies to the printing press, and that, like, just like the printing press in like 1454 was like the creation of the ability to be able to capture information and knowledge. And that for 500 years was really the dominant medium in which people were able to communicate with each other. And through that process, you start to have the cultivation of like peer review journals and novels and, you know, other ways of using writing and the linear ways of capturing knowledge to be able to share. And it really democratized the access to knowledge. And that we're really about 100 years into like this journey into a 500-year cycle of computing technologies and electricity that started with like a moving picture and then television and radio and then, you know, into the internet and mobile phone technologies and now virtual and augmented reality technologies, Internet of Things, artificial intelligence. We're on this path towards it being more of a communications medium that we're using, but also something that's embedded into our fabric of lives with the way that algorithms are able to shift and modulate our experience. And so rather than capturing information and knowledge, this new experiential age that we're in is really about democratizing and capturing human experience. And what do we want to do with that now that we can capture that like in a bottle? Like what kind of experiences do we want to have? What does the economy look like when in this new experiential economy? And how do we get everybody involved in ways that you can start to really dissolve the boundaries of borders? You know, I've had a number of different conversations at Laval Virtual where at the same time I'm talking from someone from Austria and South Africa and New Zealand. You know, it's just like people from all over the world being able to come together at the same time and be able to have these conversations. So I feel like it's that the we're about 100 years in into this, and that we've already seen so much change in just in the course of our lifetimes. And to try to like get a sense of how it will continue to change, it's really quite mind-blowing, especially when you look at it in the context of everything that's happened in the course of all of human history about, you know, the pace of which things are changing.
I know, dude. I know. It's so exciting. And I honestly feel, and I know it's always like the best time to be alive, but like I feel so lucky to be here, to be able to have these conversations and to be able to dick around with all of this stuff. I really do feel like this is a pivotal time in human history. I feel like we are on the precipice of something very, very big. And I feel like virtual reality is scratching at the surface of that. And I am just fucking stoked to be here, man. I think it's so fun. It's so exciting. And I'm living for conversations like this one right now.
Absolutely. So we're an hour and a half in. Kent, is there anything that you would like to really, anything else that you'd like to talk about?
You took the thought right out of my head. Like you mentioned to me earlier that, you know, there's been stuff that you like wanted to have the opportunity to like dive in deeper into. So like what needs to be talked about right now that people are not talking about?
Well, so I think that VR is going to represent a paradigm shift. So do you want to talk about what that paradigm shift is and what that
might look like? Let's get it, baby. Let's get it.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I want to first hear, before I dive in, my thoughts. I want to hear what your thoughts are in terms of what do you think, how is VR going to shift our paradigms?
I feel like it is, I'm, like I mentioned earlier in the show, I'm kind of this like, I don't know, I'm like halfway between like a spiritual hippie and a scientist kind of. I've done a lot of martial arts practice. When I was living in Sedona, I did a lot of Eastern philosophy stuff, a lot of meditation. I did Qigong practice. I actually practiced Kung Fu for a couple of years, and I gained a lot of perspective during that. For me, virtual reality, I feel, is like a manifestation of our ability to tap into the multiple realities, to shift in and out of experiences, to unlock that lucid dreaming potential in a way that we never really realized was possible. You know, I can't help but feel like we contribute to the reality that we want to experience with our intention, and that the shift of intention is happening in the world, and stuff like virtual reality is helping animate that for people, or helping demonstrate that for people. You know, you put a VR headset on, and for some people that might be their first taste of something completely outside the what they thought was possible. You know, they put the headset on, their fucking mind is blown. They're like, holy shit, I had no idea. It feels like I'm there. You know, which I think somebody who became lucid in a dream for the first time would probably have a similar experience. So for me, it's almost like this manifestation of the human being's ability to like choose the reality that it wants to experience based on its intention. And I feel like we're starting to see the beginning of something that looks like that.
Hmm. What about you, Skiva?
I see it kind of as, I feel like we're always working towards this oneness, you know, especially, you know, spiritually. I think VR is kind of a gateway to that oneness almost. Being able to empathize with certain people's situations that, you know, being put into situations where you can empathize, where normally you wouldn't be able to experience these types of things. There's so much potential here in being able to all get together, become extremely educated. I think VR is probably the best education platform. I think it will be the best education platform within the next decade. But I really feel like the oneness of VR and just bringing people together, you know, because it completely takes distance and it takes space out of the equation, and it just puts you in a room with anyone that you want to be with. You know what I mean? And I really feel like it's very important, just to the overall human experience, to be able to get close to anyone from anywhere in the world that has all kinds of different experiences and ways they've grown up in different countries and different places, and really just be able to kind of unify, mm-hmm. if you will. So, well, it's kind of my two cents.
Yeah, well, I think for me, I ask a lot of people about the ultimate potential. So this these answers kind of invoke, you know, those answers that I would normally hear. And for me, I try to boil it down to like, VR is going to allow us to change the way that we understand and relate to ourselves, the way that we relate to other people, the way we relate to Earth, and the way that we relate to all of reality. And I think to be able to potentially go into VR and to understand more aspects of ourselves, and to, you know, go from an experience economy to a transformational economy. So what's it mean to on demand have transformational experiences? And what's that mean to transform from what into what? And how do you even have different conceptual frameworks around that? So I do think that things like consciousness hacking and things like technodelics and having these either peak experiences or contemplative practices to be able to train yourself to be able to do things you couldn't do before, that's going to be a huge part. But I think there's some deeper aspects of moving from reductive materialism into process philosophy orientation. So what's that mean? It means that rather than just seeing things as like these kind of almost abstracted 2D or physical objects that have like the billiard ball type of causal mindset in terms of causality, it can start to potentially allow us to have a more sophisticated metaphoric representation of complex dynamics that we could only see if they were an immersive experience to be able to potentially interact with and to participate into. And so having models of reality that are way more sophisticated and than we've seen before. Also, when I went to the joint mathematics meeting to talk about notation and mathematical notation, so there's this connection between the languages and the notation that we use and the symbolic representations that we have that to be able to explain these different concepts. Well, what's it mean now to be able to have a 3D spatial notation, to be able to talk about concepts that up to this point we haven't been able to talk about before? And talking to some of the philosophy of math folks who are mathematicians, they're talking about how sometimes the typography of the printing presses were limiting what kind of notation that the mathematicians could have. And so they were really bounded to this like linear way of thinking about things. And so once you can start to have a spatial notation, then how is that going to change the way that we think? I think of logographic languages like Japanese or Chinese have these pictograms that actually embed within them a lots of their symbolic context. And so how can we start to create a larger language within virtual reality that then starts to mimic some of those same logographic type of capabilities of seeing how things are contextually relative to each other in a space, but to allow us to communicate in ways that go deeper than we could communicate before, potentially even getting to the point where it's able to read our thoughts, our minds, our intentions, to be able to like close the gap between our imagination and how we express that into the world with the brain-computer interfaces and whatnot. But I think the on the other side of this is going to be people who have these direct experiences with a VR that then challenge them to ask about the nature of reality. Perhaps part of your own path, which is that philosophers have been talking about a lot of these questions for like millennia. You know, it's like these are not new questions. What's new is that you now have the capability to have embodied experiences for you to understand some of the deeper concepts that they were talking about. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a diffusion that happens with the concepts that have been explored for a long, long time. But now it's like democratizing more people to start to engage in these discussions now that they're able to have direct experience.
Right. And it's less, it's a lot easier to do than 2 years of Kung Fu. And it's a lot less invasive than taking an eighth of mushrooms or two hits of LSD. You know, like it's just giving us the opportunity to tap into some of these things that are ultimately like impossible to express with like the dead system of words that we use to communicate, and starts to give people immersive experiences that can like reveal parts about themselves to, you know, reveal themselves to themselves using light and sound. Or, you know, however else it manages to manifest as this technology gets better and better.
Absolutely. So I have an interesting take on this. So what if we kind of went opposite? So we're talking about how we want to go in and be able to experience things from other people's perspectives and to be able to empathize and be able to do all these things. What do you think about the opposite of that, where we might become kind of desensitized to some things that we might go into experience of virtuality? And one of the things that makes me ask that is, you know, I had an experience in Blade and Sorcery one time, right? Like that game, I don't know if you've ever played it, but it's pretty much just a murder simulator, right? You go in and you just kill people in any way that you can possibly think mm-hmm. of. And, you know, and I remember grabbing this character, and it allows you to actually take the knife and like cut their throat. And like, I remember how I felt, how wrong I felt, how I felt like I just did something really wrong, even though it was in a video game. But that video game was more immersive than anything I've ever felt before. So do you think people will desensitize themselves to things like, you know, to brutal violence and things like that? I mean, this is kind of the age-old question, right? Does like video games cause people to be violent? But does it cause you to desensitize from these types of things, do you think?
Yeah, this is certainly one of those ethical questions. And I've also had an experience at Silicon Valley Virtual Reality Conference team. The second SVR, there was a PlayStation VR, and it was an experience where I like shot someone for the first time in VR and ever like in any sort of context or situation. And it was this disturbing to me. It did feel wrong. And since then I've shot a lot of people in VR, and I I think our brains can in some ways differentiate the difference between reality and not reality, but in other ways it is just the same as being a memory of that.
Right.
I think there's a good function of that kind of moral check and balance to say like, oh, this feels wrong. Cause it is wrong to do that.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of what games have done have been trying to abstract out things into like, they're robots, they're aliens, they're, you know, not mm-hmm. human, you know, so
zombies.
They're zombies. Yeah. They're, you know, there's something that's an abstraction where you can't actually see their faces. And I think once you start to incorporate the faces and have people dissociate to that, then I think, yeah, it starts to get into this area of like, why are we doing this again? What's the intention? And I think this gets into the, one of the other paradigm shifts, which is the final causation. So final causation is something that, well, there's like four different causes. There's material cause, efficient cause, formal causation, and final causation. So the final causation I mentioned earlier, which is like the intention, the purpose of like, why are mm-hmm. we doing this? And I think that the, when you reduce things down to their component parts, it's difficult to trace the evolution of a final cause, and whether or not that exists or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you start to look at things holistically, then you can start to look at things like in terms of systems, and you can say, well, it appears to be that part of the final cause of our political system is that it's, you know, trying to have all these companies buy the votes and, you know, have a certain outcome in terms of the dynamics of our political system. But also it's important to match together what somebody's saying and what they're doing. And if there's a difference between what they're saying and what they're doing, then you're trying to suss out what their deeper intentions are. What's the algorithm that's actually driving them?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that we are in the state of trying to do a better job at determining what people's final intent, what their final cause is, what their intention is, why are they doing this? And that part of it is like gaining our own sense of cultivating an awareness of watching people on Twitch and seeing how authentic they are and whether or not they're doing something just to get money or doing because they really intrinsically enjoy something. But that as we go into virtual reality experiences, we can, especially in terms of education, like education has really removed this final causation from the process of education. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you learning it? And so when you're able to connect something to why you want to do it, then from there, everything sort of orchestrates around it. Then you can start to go on this YouTube wormhole. You can go start to create people interacting.
Well, when I think about VR, you know, and like the example of like killing someone, you know, I can't help but just like, for me, it seems obvious that it's simply expression, you know, just it's like art, like people do it like because it feels good, because there's expression in the movement and there's expression in the experience. And, you know, I often, you know, when we talk about like the ethics of that, you know, I wonder, like, I think about people with like sexual deviations, you know, someone who just like wants to do something that they should not fucking do. And there's like pedophiles and shit out there, people who do shit to fucking kids that like traumatizes the fuck out of these children, you know, but like, you know, where's the ethical line for somebody who like, you know, creates a VR experience where they're like performing pedophilia or something like that? You know, it's victimless to an extent. The guy gets to have his expression of doing this insanely fucked up thing. And it's essentially victimless.
Yeah. And this is an open question in terms of like, is it therapeutic or is it?
Right. Or are we feeding a fire that we should not be feeding?
Yeah, and I think this gets to deeper questions around trauma and how we negotiate trauma, how do we actually heal from trauma. I think the deeper question is like, if there's these social ills that we're having in our society, like how do we, well, first of all, just talk about them in a way that it can be just honestly addressed. I think because there are a lot of taboos around all that, you can't even really talk about it, which then sort of propagates the problem. So
right.
VR be a way to actually have an experiential component that could be able to give some help for people who wouldn't normally, you know, would there be so many, I mean, there's legal implications of all this too. And so, I mean, for me, there's deeper intentions for how this can be a healing technology.
Right. I definitely understand that, but I can't help but feel like that this would manifest before that had the ability to catch up to it. Like this is something that we would still need to address, even regardless of whether or not that deeper intention existed. Like somebody's probably going to make that, you know what I mean? Or something similar that kicks up that conversation of the moral implications of what they're doing in virtual reality.
Yeah. Yeah, well, these are, you know, some of the open questions for how we navigate that, especially when we move into, like right now we have a top-down control model where things are censored and you're able to, you know, basically turn off the DNS. There's ways to prevent stuff from getting out, but there's already ways of doing the decentralized, you know, kind of dark web approach, peer-to-peer sharing. And so how do you censor this type of information? Is there ways to take it back or to prevent it from spreading once it gets out there? And it becomes, I think a lot of times people will see the technology as the root of the problem, but they're actually kind of gets down to these more fundamental aspects of things that are kind of toxic within the culture. And how do you address those? I think that's like a thing we haven't really fully figured out yet. And I think it's something that, obviously we're, you know, I don't know what the solution is, other than what I can say is that we have to find a way to holistically approach all of these things and look at all these different angles and, you know, recognize that even if you did try to take an approach of trying to censor it as the technology evolves, it's still going to exist. And so the problem doesn't go away just because it's able to just do that. You have to, I guess the sort of deeper philosophical principle is like, either you're attacking the symptom of the problem or you're attacking the core root of the problem.
Right.
How do you attack the core root of some of these problems?
And right.
That's like the, you know, an open question as far as I know, you know, how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're still watching the technology develop, and it's as it becomes more profound that these questions are going to become more pressing. You know, right now we're having a hard time, you know, finding a forum for this type of conversation, which is really why we started this podcast initially in the first place. And as the technology becomes more profound and more integrated into, you know, mainstream life, these questions are really going to become pressing, and we're going to have to start, you know, we're gonna have to take it from the podcast and into the fucking boardroom or wherever it is that these decisions get made, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's at least two other main points I wanted to make, in terms of the, sort of philosophical implications. I mean, there's a whole long list, but one is the qualitative aspect of time. So there's a quality of time. There's not just like the quantitative of the time, but what is your experience of the time? I think we can all feel right now that there's a certain vibe of what's happening in the world that is a bit of a universal experience.
Yeah.
It's quarantine.
Bit of a universal bummer.
Yeah. And, and that in some ways, the promise of virtual reality is to be able to potentially, capture those different archetypal components of those qualities and to be able to give those to other people and sort of test the limits of empathy and how much you could sort of understand what it's like to be somebody else. But I think it's also going to help us cultivate a deeper awareness of these different archetypal potentials within our experiences and for us to be able to put them into an experience and to be able to explain and talk about it. So I've spent probably around 50 hours in Half-Life Alyx up to this point. And so nice. 24 playing through it and a lot of times hacking through it and analyzing it and deconstructing it, looking at the textures, looking at the lighting and really trying to figure out like, how is this experience modulating my experience? Like, why do I enjoy it so much as it goes from like, picking up the resin to like being in combat, to solving a puzzle, to hearing the story, you know, it's sort of like going in between all of these different aspects of the experience. And if that's an experience that most people have, then what is it about that experience that we can start to talk about and explain and analyze in a way that we've never been able to unpack before? Like we can really get into the roots of the roots of the code and to mod it and hack it and to change it and to experiment and to see, you know, slightly do these variations. I mean, to me, that's one of the most exciting things.
In Same, dude. Cannot wait to see what comes out of this.
You know, to be able to mod it and change it and play with it. It's a whole new platform to be able to experiment with. And so, but it's a learning platform as well, because you're able to have what your experience is. You give your experience to other people and you're able to do this calibration. Like, is what I like what other people like? Mm-hmm. And then you start to learn deeper aspects of, like, you know, who knew Beat Saber was going to be the thing that was going to be the biggest rhythm game. I loved Audio Shield. I love Soundboxing, and I loved Beat Saber when I played it at GDC before it released. And I was like totally excited, but I was also excited about Audio Shield and Soundboxing. So it was like things that, like, I was wondering why there wasn't as much excitement about these things until Beat Saber came along. So what was it about that wasn't included? And so, or was it the right timing? So it's like all these things that go into being at the right time, the right quality of the experience, the quality of the time, and also the deeper archetypal potentials that are included in the experiences. And for us to be able to have this calibration process for us to be able to have the language, but also to connect to each other on it.
Mm-hmm. God damn. Keep going, man. This is so good.
Right on. So we're almost at that 2-hour mark.
Okay.
And Alex's green square behind him is starting to get darker.
Just keep tapping.
The sun goes down in Phoenix.
I know. I can't wait till I can join you in the same space again. It's like, it's a really nice dynamic. I like being able to do that. And I'm glad that we've managed to like put together a format that works, you know, being remote. But it's just cool to be in the same space, you know, and share the energy and, you know, be able to like chill after the show and hang out and stuff like that. I definitely miss it. So that'll be cool. And also the, you know, green box thing, cause it's too bright. Like if I turn the lights up at the beginning of the show, I'm like, whitewashed out. But by the end of the show, it comes in. So, you know, it's whatever.
Real quick. We do a giveaway every week, where you can go into the description of the video and you can find our Gleam giveaway and you can enter to win from a whole list of different things. We got games on there. We got shit you can wear on there. We got stands and we got controller covers. We just got all kinds of cool things you can pick from. So go ahead and hop down in there, enter that contest, get yourself some free awesome VR stuff. Mm-hmm. And last week's winner was Benoit, I believe. I'm sure I am hacking that name. I'm sure. Benoit. And he is from France, and he picked Payday 2 in VR. Yeah. So
we need to get in there and rob a bank sometime, dude. We tried to that one time, but I was having some issues. Oh, we need
for
to
sure
do that.
I think that would be super fun. It's definitely a good time.
But yeah, like we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we are trying to grow this audience, so definitely click the subscribe button if you are here hanging out with us and you enjoy this kind of content. We are going to continue to have philosophical conversations here. Other shows will focus more on games and more on news or whatever, and it just kind of flows depending on who we had on the show. Of course, today we had Mr. Ken Bai, and it has been so awesome to have you here, man. Do you want to like give us some final thoughts about today's discussion?
I'd say that one thing I'd say is that on one hand, I in my past I've been more on the side of believing, a lot of just being credulous and believing and wanting to believe, but also the value of the skeptic and one of the things when I went to a philosophy conference, I walked away with this level of epistemic humility, which is like, I don't know what I really know. Like, do I know anything? And so sort of going between this dialectic between like, okay, here's what I think is happening. And then like saying, okay, I have no idea. I'm completely skeptical of what we can actually say. And so I think finding the balance between those two things of believing and not believing, and myself, it's been a journey. And I think there's still a lot of things that VR has the capabilities to start to potentially address different deep questions about the nature of consciousness, the nature of reality, you know, and start to look at these different ethical issues, but also, you know, how do we relate to each other and how do we build a society that we want to live into and that, mm-hmm. that we get excited about, and that has different dynamics than the ones that we have right now. I feel like right now is an opportunity to pause and to reevaluate. There's a lot of things that are happening in the world that were not necessarily in harmony with what's happening on the wider earth. And so this is a bit of an opportunity to maybe practice some more sustainable practices and maybe get back onto a right path, because while this COVID-19 may be a blip, the climate crisis that could be coming could be even more severe. And so this is a real opportunity for us to do what we need to do to be able to really be in harmony with ourselves, with each other, with the earth, and this dialectic between, you know, just seeing ourselves as individuals versus like seeing us as a community. And I think that's one of the things that I'm seeing is the community aspects of what's happening right now. And for us to take our own experiences and still create these simulations that we can have other people also experience, and then we can start to connect to them. And I think that those connections and being relationship to other people and the planet and the earth and to yourself as the, you know, kind of the final thought that I'd have. And a lot of the work that I do is on Voices of VR podcast. You can check that out. You can support me on Patreon. I am supported by the listeners. And so if you enjoy the type of work that I'm doing, then please do become a subscriber and help to sustain this type of work that I'm doing. And thank you so much for having me on this. To be able to do a deep dive.
We are huge fans. It's honestly an honor for us to have you on the show, and it was an honor for us to have you comment on our first episode. You were just right there when the gates opened, and that meant a lot to us. So thank you so much for your time and for joining us here. And I mean, there's still shit that I would have loved to get into that, of course, you can't do in 2 hours. So yeah. I would love for you to join us again when we start up season two and we have a little bit more to talk about.
All right. Sounds great.
Awesome. So, everyone out there, listen to. So everything we talked about today will affect your life at some point. And I feel like this stuff is definitely food for thought. You know, think about the you know, some of the moral and ethical things that we talked about today. And like Kent was saying, think about, you know, we have this chance to kind of reset right now. And I think, you know, it's not something we should take lightly. So thank you so much, Kent. It was an honor.
This was super, super fun. Everybody, this has been Between Realities, episode 12. Mr. Kent Bai, Skiva, thank you so much for pushing the buttons and keeping the show up and running, man. Really appreciate you. And to everyone watching, thank you for being a part of this with us. Subscribe, like it, join us in the conversation next week. Who's our guest next week?
Next week, we have Ty from Ty Tech.
Oh, Ty Hurd. Yep, yeah. Ty Hurd from Tyco Tech. He is the owner and operator of one of the bigger Oculus Quest communities on Facebook, and he has a YouTube channel where he does like a lot of explaining like modding on the Quest, how to install side Quest, how to get weird programs up and running, how to change the letters in Beat Saber. Like, he is super, super knowledgeable, and we're really excited to have him on the show. So thanks again, everyone, and we will see you next week.
Adios.
Take care.
Bye.